Hey everybody, this is Kendra, and you are listening to Nocturnal Distractions. It's been a little while. I know. But that is also why I am bringing you all a little bonus episode this week to tide you over until basically I'm able to put the finishing touches on my next episode in the Gradations of Evil Scale series. As those episodes I have found, like I've said before, they take a bit more time to do the in-depth research and the fact-checking, etc., than I've had to do on pretty much any case before I started that series. And if I only focus on, like, one case like that for a long period of time, I have found it makes my brain start to feel like oatmeal mush. And I cannot focus on it anymore. And then I start to try to, like, avoid it, kind of, or procrastinate, which I'm really good at. And then it takes even longer. So a break was definitely, it was needed. So I think that's probably what I'm going to be doing from now on. Obviously, I'm still going to keep going with that series, but I have to give myself, like, a bonus episode in between, like, each level, unless I do have them lined up back-to-back, because they are more in-depth, and they do take more research, because it does get into more of, like, background and psychology and different things like that. So, this is just going to be a little kind of a bonus thing. And I found a doozy of a bonus to kind of tell you guys. Just going to say that. I'm going to bring you, basically, it's the story of one woman who by the age of 40 had five husbands. Five marriages, five husbands. And the marriages ended in the following ways and in the following order. So she was divorced, and then she was widowed, then she was divorced, divorced again, and widowed again. Now, here's a twist to this whole thing. The two times that she was widowed, technically, she wasn't widowed by the same man, but she was widowed by the same heart. Like, literally, heart, like the actual heart, like, you know, your heart in your chest, you know, that thing that pumps blood to all different parts of your body, that part. Yeah, she was widowed twice by the same one. The same one. I know what you're thinking right now. You're going, all right, how many days have you been up straight and what are you smoking, Kendra? And nothing. Nothing, nothing at all. I mean, I've been up for a little while, but not smoking anything. So just stick with me here, all right? So I stumbled upon this case or this story through one of these apps that I have on my phone. It's called Ultimate Facts. And like up to 15 different times a day, it will bring up a random fact like on my lock screen. And if I find it interesting enough, I can read the longer article on it, basically. So it'll give me animal facts or people facts or facts about different places, things like that. So yesterday, it popped up with a short little, you know, blip saying, Sonny Graham's life. A man received the heart of a suicide victim, married his widow, and years later killed himself in the same way his donor did. My brain did an automatic double take, and I'm like, wait, what? Clicked on article. I need more information on this shit. So after reading the very brief article, and this happened back in like 2008, so let's keep that in mind throughout this whole thing too. So I read the brief article, right? And I was left with more questions than answers, because I felt like there's more to this story than is in this brief article. There has to be. So I decided to do what I do best, and I went down the Google rabbit hole. Way down in it. I mean, not way down in it. I'm sure I could have gone farther, but I wanted I decided after reading like the first article that this would be a good bonus one, like episode. So I didn't want to go too deep because then it's not really saving me much time and I'm not getting any content out. So anyway, if you thought that the story couldn't get any weirder than the fact that somebody received a suicide victim's heart, married the widow of the guy who committed suicide, and then years later wound up committing suicide himself, you'd be wrong. Now, while this isn't going to be like a murder or a conspiracy sort of crime case, you could make it out to be that way, but it's not really what it's set up to be. But you are listening to Nocturnal Distractions, and the story does raise some interesting questions. And if nothing else, some interesting situations. And it did cause me to get distracted. And it was late at night. And it was late at night again last night. And I'm late, so late that it's early morning-ish, mid-morning-ish now. So there's that. So it still fits into my whole Nocturnal Distractions thing. Besides, okay, this is my podcast, and I can do what I want. So there. Take that and stuff. So if you look up the short article, you might be tempted to almost like feel sorry for this poor gal, right? She lost her husband to suicide, and then she found love again with the man who received his heart, only to have that husband take his own life in the same way. So it was like love was found, love was lost, and found and lost again. Or was it? After all, after a little digging, there's always, like, more to a story, I think we've found out. By the end, the question you might be asking yourself is, does an organ retain living cell memories that are then transplanted into the recipient along with the organ, causing the recipient to take on some characteristics of their donor, or maybe some of the feelings and hardships felt by the donor as well? Or is this merely a story of a woman who expected too much from the men she chose to marry, and did she drive them to end things the way they did? Or, despite the cause of death listed, did they both actually die of self-inflicted gunshot wounds? I'll leave that up to you to decide. However, let's start at the beginning of this case of romance, tragedy, a whole lot of sneaking around, and a few lies. Lies just sprinkled in there for fun. We're going to go back to 1988. A man named Terry Cottle, who was about 26, I think, at the time. It wasn't really clear, but I'm guessing around 26. Was living with his wife and their two young daughters in one of the apartment buildings they managed in Jasper County, South Carolina. Cottle's boss had a daughter, a young woman in her early 20s, petite, beautiful, with auburn hair and hazel eyes. She had looks that would draw any man in, and apparently they did. Her name was Cheryl Sweat. Either Sweat or Sweet, I couldn't quite figure that out, but it's going to be her married name at the time, so it changes throughout here. And she was actually going through trouble period in her life. She was in the process of having her 3-year marriage annulled because her husband was actually married to someone else. So that's the thing. That's a thing. I mean, that's a thing. I'm going to go ahead and give her that right there. I can't even imagine you married somebody for 3 years just to find out they've been married the whole time. So though it was not specifically stated anywhere that this is when the relationship between her and Terry starts, we're going to assume that it is because it happened behind Cottle's wife's back. And that part we do know, because even though Cheryl's husband was the one that was still married, the fact that she had started a new relationship apparently brought out his jealous streak, as he was the one who actually called Cottle's wife sometime later on, saying, quote, "I just want you to know that your husband is seeing my wife." cat's out of the bag. So Terry Cottle then filed for divorce. And 9 days after it was granted, in May of 1989, he and Cheryl were married. Cottle adopted Cheryl's two sons, Christopher and Timmy, from her previous marriage. And they then had a daughter together, Jessica. In late 1994, the couple went from living in a single wide trailer to a double wide trailer in the town of Monk's Corner, South Carolina. So far, you know, their marriage seemed to be working out pretty well. Their little family was growing. It's been 5 years at this point. So since meeting and marrying Cheryl, Cottle had actually earned his GED, which, for those of you who aren't in the United States, a GED is like, it's a high school, it's like high school diploma equivalent. So basically, he had dropped out of high school. He had never actually graduated his high school. So he'd never gotten his diploma. So he got the equivalent of that. So that's what the GED is. So he had earned his GED. And he had worked towards and received his real estate license. And by the age of 33, had also become a certified emergency medical technician. All the while he was doing that, he was also working to support his family while Cheryl studied for her nursing degree. Now, I don't know about all you guys out there, but that's pretty impressive for the 6 or 7 years that have passed in this amount of time. I mean, look, I'm older than 33, and I don't even got my shit together like that. Like, I'm doing pretty good. But apparently, Cheryl did not think so, and it was not enough for her. And she felt that he was not giving her the life that she deserved to be living. And by the beginning of 1995, it had become a little too much. And Cottle had moved out of the trailer and in with his sister, Tammy Erickson. Before long, though, Cheryl started coming around, perhaps realizing, at the time, just how much Cottle provided for her and their children. She would cook dinner for the family and spend the night in Terry's room. So, Cottle's room, sorry, sometimes I go back for Cottle's room. Tammy, his sister, was pregnant with her second child, though, and needed that extra room for her nursery. So she told her brother to make a decision. Quote, if you love her and you want to make this work, then you need to go home and be with her, she said. So he did. But only 3 weeks later, on March 15th, the couple got into a huge argument. Cheryl told Cottle that she couldn't stay married to a man who made less money than she did. At some point, her son Timmy recalls she took off her wedding ring and threw it over the garden fence. She threw a tantrum, everybody. Threw a tantrum. So this seemed to be the last straw. And by the next morning, they had agreed that Cottle should leave. As he prepared to go, Cottle went into the bathroom. There was a gunshot. At first, Cheryl told sheriff's investigators she heard their 10-year-old son, Christopher, shouting that Cottle had shot himself. She said she ran into the bathroom and found him on the floor with the revolver still in his hand. However, in a second version attached to the coroner's report, Cheryl said she was eating when one of her boys had yelled, "Mom, Dad has a gun." She said she had ran towards the bathroom and saw Terry standing up and looking at her with the gun in his hand. She said that she yelled something like, "Terry, wait." And this was at about the same time as she pushed on the door to try to get into the bathroom. And at the same time, she heard a shot, the report says. "Baby, help me. Help me, I'm dying," he gasped as she recalled his words. Now, usually when something like this goes on and you've got somebody telling the story two different ways that I get it. I don't know how I would react in that kind of a situation, let's face it. But I don't know how I'm feeling about this right now, you know? I mean, I understand how some people would react afterwards. Like, you never know how you're going to react, right? But I feel like you would remember whether or not you actually saw your husband shoot himself or whether you saw the aftermath of it. Like, I feel like those are important, like, details that are going to be traumatizing one way or the other. But you're going to keep them straight. Just my opinion. Could be totally wrong. Just my opinion. So the .22 caliber slug entered Cottle's skull just behind the right ear. There was no exit wound. Cottle did not die that day. On March 20th, 4 days after being in the trauma unit at Medical University of South Carolina in Charleston, Cheryl agreed to take Cottle off life support and donate his organs. He was 33 years old at the time, and Cheryl was 27 years old. So, she decided, you know, take him off life support and donate his organs. Now we're going to get into some of the real meat and potatoes here of this whole story. So when Cheryl decided to take her husband off of life support, 57-year-old Sonny Graham, who lived on Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, got the call he had been waiting for more than a year. So let's reverse now in time a little bit. Let's learn about Sonny Graham here. So Remus T. Sonny was his nickname. Graham was a native of Lyons, Georgia. He was an Air Force veteran, avid hunter and fisherman, and what his buddy Bill Carson called a man's man. Take that as whatever that means back in the 90s, whatever a man's man was back then. As the longtime manager of the central plant for Hargray Communications, which is Hilton Head's telephone service provider, and Hilton, by the way, for anybody who's not in the United States or I don't know where Hilton's all or at. Hilton is a hotel. It's a franchise of a hotel. I don't even know if that's the right word. It's a hotel. It's a big hotel. You see them in various places. But it was a big one on this island, basically, where he lives. And they did the communications, like the telephone and different stuff for Hilton. And so he knew about everybody that was on that South Carolina barrier island. And even the local high school football field was named in his honor. He was a fixture at the Heritage Golf Tournament at the island's Sea Pines Resort. So like this place that he lived, it was basically like living on a resort. Like it's just like hotel after hotel and beach and beaches and beaches. Beaches, by the way, not bitches. I'm sure there were some of them too, but you know what I mean. So anyway, he was always a fixture at the Heritage Golf Tournament, and he would return year after year, even after retiring from Hargray, to volunteer to run the tourney's communications trailer. He was not only a staple in the community, but also a respectable family man. He and his wife, Elaine, had been married for more than 3 decades and had 2 children, Gray and Michelle. But all good luck doesn't last. And in 1994, he came down with a virus that damaged his heart muscle. By early 1995, the avid hunter and woodsman struggled to even get up from a chair and was on the verge of a congestive heart failure. His doctors put his name on the heart transplant list. Which all leads us up to 5 p.m. on March 20th and the phone call that would change Graham's life. A heart had become available. Cottle's heart. Graham was at the hospital and in surgery within the next 12 hours. 6 months after the transplant, Graham was well enough to go on a fishing trip with Bill Carson to Alaska. He He joked that having a 33-year-old's heart had done wonders for his libido. A doctor suggested he see a counselor in case of any guilt that many organ recipients often feel, because while you're I've never had an organ, I've never needed one, but I can only imagine that while obviously you are relieved, you are so happy to finally be getting this organ to keep you alive, you also understand or I think after that, like, euphoria kind of wears off. It hits a lot of organ recipients that someone else had to die in order for you to get this organ. And unless you're getting like a kidney or something that someone's able to do a live donation. But most of the time, you know that someone had to die in order for you to be able to live. And so a lot of them go through a grieving process just because of that. And so, I mean, that he was asked, like, do you want to see a therapist of any sort, you know, to help with that? And he basically said, I'm sorry the other guy died, but this is my heart now. So, I guess he was okay with it. However, his friends noticed some subtle changes. For example, a craving for beer, which was not something that Graham ever drank, and a taste for hot dogs. The beer was later found to be Cottle's brand of beer that he always drank, and hot dogs were one of Cottle's favorite foods. Was this that living cell of memory in the works? And there has been some research done to this, by the way. I did dig into that a little bit, where organ recipients have found themselves having a taste for certain things that they didn't before, or music, or just different things like that. In November 1996, Graham asked the South Carolina Organ Procurement Agency to forward a letter to the donor's family. His children told him it was a bad idea, but he wanted to thank Cottle's wife. The letter was followed by a reply, and then another letter was sent and another received, and then some photographs were exchanged, and soon Cheryl Cottle called Graham. 2 months later, in January of 1997, Graham and his wife Elaine met Cheryl for dinner at a waterfront restaurant in Charleston. Graham, it seems, couldn't keep his eyes off of the 28-year-old widow. He's got that 33-year-old heart going. I'm not sure on the... Sorry. And Graham, at this point, I think his age would probably be about 58, 59. So keep in mind, he's 30 years older than her. Not saying that's, you know, whatever, you do you, but about twice the age, almost. I'm just saying. He said, quote, I fell in love with Cheryl the first time we met, he would later confess in a letter. The feeling, however, was not mutual. At least, not at first. Because she was actually engaged to someone else. And in April of 1997, Cheryl married husband number three. We're on husband number three now, George Watkins. Elaine and Graham attended the wedding, and Graham himself, standing in for Cheryl's late father, gave her away as the bride. So he walked her down the aisle as a stand-in for her father at her third wedding. Yay. I get the ick from that. I get the ick. Cheryl and Watkins went on to have a son in January of 1999. Around that same time, Elaine Graham learned that her husband's relationship with Cheryl was more than a fatherly, as in, like, it's not, it's, yeah, there's some stuff going on there. In a letter to Elaine, Graham apologized to his wife for being the SOB you said I was, and destroying a relationship we had for 40 plus years. I let someone come between you and I, which should never have happened, he wrote. I look back on everything and see where I gave up love and companionship for attention and affection. It would be wonderful if I could turn back our lives for the past 4 years. A little late for that, it sounds like. Because at this point, both Cheryl and her husband and Graham and his wife have both separated. So now they're able to have their love out in the open. So shortly after a judge declared the Grahams' 38-year marriage over in October of 2001, Cheryl and Graham moved into a mobile home on the land he'd bought in his hometown, because at that time he was actually building her own house to her specifications. Custom house. Getting that life she wants and deserves. However, they have not wed. They're not married yet. And the newly domestic bliss did not last. In May 2002, Cheryl left. Graham promptly sued her and accused her of reneging on some loans and refusing to return a diamond ring. She turned around in a counterclaim that when she told Graham the relationship wasn't going to work out, he became more possessive and threatened her. Can you say red flags? Red flags. In the midst of this court case, Cheryl somehow found time to meet and marry husband number four. Got that four. John B. Johnson Jr., a corrections officer at the Georgia prison where Cheryl had been working as a contracted nurse. I guess she just loves to be loved. She's looking for love in all the wrong places, but that's just me. Oh, and in case anyone's wondering about right now, any of the articles I've read up to like this point didn't mention specifically where the heck all of her children were at this point. Because remember, she had two sons from husband one. She had a daughter from Cottle. A son from husband three. But up until now, it's like, I don't know where they are. I don't even know how old they are. I got nothing on them right now. There's some mention coming later on. But in case anybody's wondering, like, where the heck are her kids at? That's where. So go back to marriage number four. Within a year, it began to crumble. Just like everything with a super strong foundation. I mean, not strong foundation. Shocking. On Thanksgiving 2003, sheriff's deputies were called and both husband and wife accused the other of domestic abuse. However, they still decided that Christmas time would be a great time for a reconciliation. Johnson, the husband, says. But during this time, an incident occurred. That was a tad concerning. One evening while in bed, Cheryl began talking about suicide. When she failed to return from the bathroom later, Johnson went to check on her and said he found her clutching his .22 caliber revolver. They wrestled over the weapon and the children, there they are. That's where the children are. Not sure which children though or how old. And Cheryl's mother rushed in. Cheryl then told them that he, as in Johnson, was the one that had gotten the gun and was threatening to shoot himself as opposed to the other way around. So she flipped the switch on that one. Johnson decided smartly that it was time to get the F out. The couple separated. By the time the divorce was final in August 2004, Johnson says, Cheryl was already wearing an engagement ring from Graham. So, was Graham in the picture the whole time here? What was Cheryl doing? For that matter, Graham, what are you doing? What's happening there? They finally got married, though, on December 8th of 2004. Graham started a landscaping company and let Cheryl's two oldest sons work for him. So, obviously her oldest sons are older. They still don't ever say how old. And a few days before their second wedding anniversary, so around 2006, the couple attended an event on Hilton Head to honor the families of organ donors. The Island Packet, which is the local newspaper, ran a story under the headline, "A Love Story Unlike Any Told." That's because it hasn't gotten to the end yet. "It's true what it says in the Bible," Cheryl told the newspaper. Sorry, I've been up for a while, so my tongue's tied. Cheryl told the newspaper, "If you live God's will and give with a happy heart, you will reap the rewards." Graham said he'd put my life in God's hands, and Cheryl was the answer to his prayers. Right up until his death, Graham was making plans for the future. He'd invite friends down to fish and was talking about the upcoming golf tournament. What no one knew was that Graham had drawn up a will. Almost no one knew he had drawn up a will. Larry Lockley says he went fishing with his uncle the last week of February 2007. And afterward, Graham showed him the will and asked if he'd be an alternate executor, which is a person who would take on the duties of an executor if, for any reason, the person named cannot fulfill the role. I had to look that up. I had no idea what the heck a alternate executor of a will was. So apparently it's somebody who, if the first person named can't, for some reason, fulfill that role, then they take on the responsibilities of it. "Ain't nothing wrong, is there?" the nephew asked. "Ain't nothing wrong at all," Graham replied, "but you never know." He gave Lockley a copy and slipped another in a briefcase on the shelf at the back of his utility shed. The week of March 20th, which would have been the 13-year anniversary of Graham's transplant, his buddy Bill Carson went down to fish for bream and bass with Graham. Graham didn't complain about his marriage. That wasn't really like him anyway. But something still wasn't right. "He just wasn't the happy-go-lucky guy I'd known my whole life, says Carson. Soon after, on an overcast spring morning, Sonny Graham drank some coffee. It was April Fool's Day, so April 1st. A little over 13 years since another man's suicide gave Graham a second chance at life. He had Cuddle's heart, and he also had his widow. Graham headed out the door for another day of work at the family landscaping business and to take his 9-year-old stepson to the dentist. But Graham made a detour to the backyard shed that he'd built. There, the 69-year-old picked up the 12-gauge Remington shotgun he'd taken on so many quail and dove hunting trips, pointed the muzzle at the right side of his throat, and pulled the trigger. Graham had made Cheryl a widow once again. Reporters and bloggers waxed on about cellular memory and whether the organ somehow held a suicide gene. Nonsense, thought Cottle's sister Tammy. As far as she was concerned, Graham's death had less to do with her brother's heart than it had to do with Cheryl, the woman with whom both men had chosen to share it. In late April, shortly after Graham's death, so like less than a month, Cheryl visited Tommy Hilton, an old friend, over drinks. She complained that Graham didn't leave me a dime. Graham had blown through his retirement funds and run up large debts, about triple the amount of his assets, trying, as he once put it, quote, to keep Cheryl in the style she wants to live. His affairs were in such disarray that both of the men designated as his executors for the will, including his nephew Lockley, declined to do it. I always thought my uncle was in pretty good financial standing, Lockley says. It was just a shock to me that his finances were in that bad a condition. Cheryl Graham did not respond to repeated requests seeking comment, but those who knew her say she did not act like a grieving widow. Really? Really? When less than a month afterwards, all you could say is he didn't leave me a dime and you sucked him dry completely? On her MySpace account, which was deactivated at the time, because remember, this is 2008 when like MySpace was still like the social media place to be. Her photo soon changed from a sweetly smiling portrait to pictures of her on a lake or drinking beer with her friends. Her screen name changed too, from simply Cheryl to Pretty Lady and then Beautiful Mess. And it was done in that like, that stupid kind of typing where you would stick in random capital letters to be kind of like edgy. I think look, I'm guilty of doing that. I'm gonna admit it. I mean, I was in college at the time though when I did it. I was not 39 years old like she is right now trying to be edgy and cool by putting like random capital letters or making your screen name Beautiful Mess. I mean, that doesn't scream grieving 39-year-old second-time widow to me. It just doesn't. And add on top of that, family members that were monitoring the account noticed that shortly after Graham's death, she posted a man's photo identifying him as her new boyfriend. I don't think she understands that everything on the internet's on the internet for everybody to see. A flirtatious message on the man's webpage from her account was dated March 26th, 6 days before Graham's death. She looking for another dude? I got nothing for this lady right now. Like I said, at first, like, I felt bad for her, right? Like, oh my God, I can't even imagine going through what she's gone through. But it's like, So this man, who is not named, confirmed to the Associated Press that agents from the Georgia Bureau of Investigation had actually interviewed him, and he had told them he no longer sees Cheryl. Although the Toombs County coroner ruled Graham's death a suicide in late May, the GBI still hasn't closed the case. Again, this was in 2008, and I didn't really see an update, but I really wasn't getting in too deep, so whether or not they did finally close that, I don't know, but that tells you something, I guess, right there. The fact that it was left open and they were interviewing people. Investigators also interviewed all three of Cheryl Graham's surviving exes. And Johnson, husband number four, was not the only one with a gun story to tell. During a 2005 dispute over custody of their grandchildren, her first husband, Isaac Bo Carter, said that Cheryl had called him and threatened to blow my brains out with her .38 pistol. A protective order was granted immediately after that. Johnson, husband four, says anyone who gets involved with his ex-wife is in for an emotional roller coaster ride. One day she hates you, and one day she loves you, and the next day she hates you, Johnson told the Associated Press. I guess I am lucky to be alive. And that is the crazy story of whatever that train wreck just was. So, what do you guys think? Do you think living cell memory in the heart organ is a thing? Like, what's your opinion on that? Do you think Cheryl kind of drove them to do it? Did she just have really terrible luck with love? Or did something more sinister kind of take place in this whole situation? I don't know. let me know by leaving me a comment on Instagram. Send me a DM on Instagram. Email me at nocturnaldistractions@gmail.com. Check out my donation pages to help fund this podcast and help me fund research sites so I can actually find all the information necessary. And if you go to my show notes, there's like a link to all the links, or you can go into my Instagram bio, which has my Linktree link, which is the link to all the links. Subscribe, rate, leave written reviews on Apple and Audible if you want to. You can do stars on Spotify. I'll be forever grateful. And my next episode out will be covering the next level in the gradations of evil scale. So it'll be level number 3. And we will be taking a trip to Ireland for that one. So stay tuned. And I love you all. And I hope you like this bonus episode. Bye.